everyone. It is Tuesday, November 19th, a little overcast, rainy, a little bit of snow, a little bit of yuck. Anyway, this is the weather report from Concord. That's why you listen to The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Ken Barnes is away. Fred Portnoy, our fabulous engineer, is sitting in for him, and I'm so glad. So, you know, I wasn't around yesterday. I was recovering from my daughter's wedding, which I really didn't need to recover from. But I wanted to just share a couple of things that I posted on Facebook in case you are one of those people who are probably smarter than me and don't look at Facebook. I sent this out, and I said, my daughter had a pop-up wedding on Sunday. She lives my dreams. And I wrote under her picture of her, and I wrote, today, November 15th, at a pop-up wedding at McNaughton's Greenhouse in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, surrounded by hundreds of blooming poinsettias, blowing fans, and unloading trucks, my New Hampshire-born daughter married the love of her life, a Shanghai-born young man. It was perfect, and it was perfect, everyone. And then as I was looking at these two people and watching their wedding and then going to this fabulous Chinese restaurant for the sort of celebratory dinner, I wrote, as I watched the impeachment hearings last week, I thought about the importance of soft power. Today at my daughter's wedding, I saw a variation on that theme. Two cultures coming together, sharing their love, respect, integrity, and understanding. So my daughter literally has a pop-up wedding, and the reason she had it in New Jersey, and she's so smart, my kid. She there are sort of dueling families, my ex-husband and myself, and we have not actually said a word to each other since 1999. And imagine raising two daughters since 1999 without saying one word. And trust me, the wedding was a continuation of not one word. So my daughter was trying to figure out, how do I thread the needle between these two warring factions? So one of the reasons why we have the wedding in New Jersey in Cherry Hill is that that's where my ex's 100-year-old, or she's 99 and three-quarters, year-old mother lives. She's an Iowa farm girl, and Winifred was able to come to the wedding, so they had this pop-up wedding a couple blocks from her nursing home in order for her to attend. So that was my daughter's homage to the Trunzo part of the family. And her homage to my part of the family was that she asked my brother's oldest son to read a story, sort of a, I don't know, what do you call it? A story that obviously it's a parable from China about community and relationship and marriage. And so he was the only one that spoke at the wedding other than the man who performed the wedding. And so in a lot of ways, she brilliantly threaded the two families together without even having to acknowledge the tension in the space. And then one last thing, she calls on her old boss when she was working in New York City. She worked for a lot of companies in New York City. And the last company she worked for, she hated the company, but she loved the people and she loved her boss. And she said to him, would you perform the wedding? And he said, absolutely, absolutely. And he gets up there and he looks at Edwin and Melissa and he says, you realize I've performed 4 or 5 weddings in the last couple of years. And then he looked at the two of them. And this is the first heterosexual wedding I've performed. You sure you two want to get hitched? I was like, so cute. He kind of looked at Edwin going, you want a girl? You want a girl? Anyway, everyone, so that's where I was. And that's what I was recovering from on Monday. And I'm really glad to be back. And joining me right now on the line is an old friend and someone who I needed to talk to because I've been watching the impeachment hearings, Bill Curry. You've been watching the impeachment hearings. I've been thinking about the 2020 candidates. I'm just amazed that Bloomberg and Deval Patrick think that we need another two more people in this race. And I had to call on you. Bill Curry is a former advisor to Bill Clinton. He ran for the governor of Connecticut twice. He writes for Salon.com. He is one of the most thoughtful people I know. And I want to start with this, Bill, and please forgive me, but I was listening to Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman this morning testify, and his opening statement is a statement that we should read to every civics class in America. And what he said was this. He said, when my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so that his three sons could have better, safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. Our collective military service is a special part of our family story in America. But then he went on. In Russia, Vindman said, His act of expressing my concerns to the chain of command in an official and private channel would have severe personal and professional repercussions. Ah, but offering public testimony involving the president would surely cost me my life. For that, he said, he was grateful for his father's decision to come to the U.S. Quote, Dad, my sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected officials is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Welcome to the program, Bill Curry. I could read that every single day. I could read that every single day. Oh, God, Donald Trump, what are you doing to this country? Anyway, welcome. Oh, sorry.
A contemporary politician whose collected speeches I would want at my bedside. But the all the witnesses in this probe, I think Vindman's may have been the best, but the opening statements of the witnesses in this impeachment probe deserve to be bound in a leather-bound edition.
They should.
Robert Mueller didn't save us. The Democratic Party didn't save us. Yeah. The House didn't save us. The Republican Party has betrayed us.
Yeah.
All these civil servants have stepped forward when no one else could do it. At least many chose to but couldn't do it effectively, and many didn't choose to at all, in elected and appointed officials and judiciary people. And these civil servants are saving the democracy to the best of their ability. It has just been an unexpected treat of all of this to watch them.
Honest to God, if I was 17 or 18 years old, I said this the other day, I'd want to be them when I grow up.
Yeah,
I want to change my course. I don't want to be a musician. I don't want to be this. I want to do these things because they're important.
A wonderful thing it would be if, in the same way that Woodward and Bernstein drew people into journalism in the 1970s after Watergate, if these heroes drew people into public service in the wake of this impeachment, after all of the crapola about the deep state, that no one who's ever worked in government believes exists, and after all of the defamation of public service beginning in the Reagan years and continuing to this day, to see how smart and professional and principled these people are, what risks they're taking. And just in case some of your listeners didn't know the context of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman's reassurance to his father, the Army has actually offered to put him, has set in motion putting him in an undisclosed location because of the seriousness of the threats that have been made upon his life and physical safety and that of his family. The Army wants to put a colonel in an undisclosed location because of the severity of the threats of right-wing attacks upon him, which make those words to his father even more eloquent and brave and patriotic. It was just an amazing thing to watch.
I heard him say it, and I stood in place. I just kept going, oh, my God, oh, my God. But, you know, it's really funny. I mean, I'm half Italian and half Norwegian, and my two uncles died in World War II. And one of my uncles died actually in the Empire State Building crash, coming home to help his grieving mother who had just lost her son in a PT boat in the South Pacific. And he had rushed home to see her, and instead he dies there. But my grandfather, as miserable and unhappy and having lost his two sons, was so proud that they served this country that he had chosen. You know, so as I was listening to him, I was thinking of my Vincenzo talking, you know, and that is the American dream, everyone. That is the American dream. They don't come here because of ethnicity. They come here because of an idea. And Donald Trump is trampling on that idea, and that's what so offends me.
So is the whole Republican Party. It is amazing how far they've all descended. One of the things, there have been so many outrages and to be reported in the last 10 days that a speech given by William Barr to the Federalist Society was somewhat overlooked.
Yes.
And in it, he talked about people he disagrees with. which is to say Democrats. And he made a very fervently pro-evangelical Christian pitch, and then said that for people who, like me, who don't vote Republican, that for us, our religion was government. Just a stunning assertion, and that we would stop at nothing, that we had no morals, that we had no ethics, that we would do anything it took to acquire more power. And I thought, wow, this coming from an alleged Christian who's supporting, you know, one of the great sinners of our time, Donald Trump,
right.
and who has abandoned all of the ethical precepts of his profession and of our democracy. I'm just stunned. And for an attorney general to give a speech like that, again, it's intimidating to in a supposedly pluralistic society, in a society that has been pluralistic throughout all of our history to this moment. What a chilling thing to hear. What an Orwellian, what a threatening statement from the chief law enforcement officer of the country. It's such a shameful moment. We're going to recover from this. We're going to get past it. But
so.
Such a shameful moment.
So I'm going to do WGBH this weekend, and one of the things I want to talk about is what's going on with the 2020 primary. And I need to tell you, so I'm going to mention this at WGBH, but I've been talking to a couple of friends, and they're exhausted. They're not only exhausted by how many choices and then the new choices, but between the impeachment and the 2020, which is what you want to talk about anyway, they don't know what to do anymore. They don't know how to spend their time. They don't know whether they need to like kick another tire or whether they need to watch the impeachment hearing. They don't know whether they need to cocoon and just think. They don't even know how to process anymore because they're so overwhelmed by the failure of the Trump administration, by in some ways the disappointment coming out of people like Barack Obama, where you know he's sort of suggesting that we can't get so progressive. And I'm like, oh, stuff it, you know, and I'm thinking really from a party that has only offered up, you know, the new Democrats, you know, who basically, you know, did the aid and the willingness of what the Republicans wanted. Let's repeal Glass-Steagall. Let the Democrats do it. Let's have a crime reform bill. Let the Democrats do it. We did everything Republicans wanted. I keep referring to Bill Clinton's years as the Republican wet dream. And I'm thinking really, and how did that turn out? Maybe it's time for us to turn the page. So it's just so exhausting. My friends don't even know how to process anymore, and they're just going to be grateful when the primary is over in New Hampshire so they can go back to sort of beginning to live another kind of a life.
The interestingly, in the debate among the presidential candidates, the progressive contingent, which is a tiny percentage of the field and now consists basically of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, while putting forward new ideas, has never tried to draw President Obama into the discussion, but a couple of Obama's own appointees and other pay-to-play Democrats did, trying to distinguish themselves on an immigration policy principally. And there was this great to-do in the press about how the Democrats criticizing Obama, what a terrible thing that was. And there's a part of me that agrees that there's no need to criticize President Obama on any personal level. I'm not sure who did that, if anyone. And I wouldn't. But at the same time, it's another agreement we all make not to come to terms with our own responsibility for the situation that we're in. And that the failure of a whole generation of Democrats from just before Clinton to just after Obama to take seriously the issues of the distribution of wealth, income, power, and opportunity in America, and to take seriously the issues of the what Anthony Kennedy called the soft corruption, but which is simply the most, which is better called systemic corruption.
Yes, systemic.
Of the democracy.
Exactly.
That our failure on those two all-important fronts is what gave us Trump, and the failure of global finance capitalism in its late stages to preserve the integrity of democracies and to enhance the economic security of the broad middle class are, after climate change, the two greatest failures of our time.
Yes.
And they have, across the Western world and in much of the rest of the world, that they've brought democracy into disrepute. and have given rise to a whole generation of people who could be called anything from autocrats to fascists. And our need in this election and going forward from this election is to take those things more seriously and to be braver and more substantive and more progressive and more principled in talking about income inequality, the concentration of power, the corruption of democracy. Those are the mistakes of a generation of Democrats, all of whom were better than the corresponding generation of Republicans, but so what? We have to get way better. We have to fix. You want to bring people together? Fix the problems that are afflicting them.
And
that's you don't do it with a meme or a slogan or a crafty piece of rhetoric. You do it by solving big problems.
So I read you a headline when we talked this morning, and I want to go back to that. And it just shocked me. The U.S. ranked 27th in the world in education and health care, down from 6th in 1990. That's today. The U.S. ranks 27th, and we ranked 6th in 1990. And I want to remind everyone, since 1990, we've had Bush, Clinton, Bush, Obama, okay? Two Republicans and two Democrats. And I said, but in 1990, we only had 99 billionaires, and today we can boast 705. So I want people to notice this. We were 6th in the world in 1990 in healthcare and education. Today we are 27th in the world. But what we know we're wildly successful at is we grow billionaires. And now the question is, and what has that meant for the rest of us? What has that meant for our country? What has that meant for our society? What has that meant for our infrastructure? What has that meant for our healthcare? We need to connect these dots. And you're right, maybe the Democrats were better, but they weren't better enough when you look at these numbers, because it took two Bushes and a Clinton and an Obama to end up with this result.
Yes, when we had the chance to do universal health care, there's a great myth that it was because of the Republicans that we didn't get it.
No.
But that's not how that story really went down. President Obama chose not to pursue a public option. It passed in the House of Representatives despite the opposition of the White House. It had 53 votes in the Senate despite the White House opposition and 59 to overcome a filibuster. And when the 60th vote, my one-time seatmate in the state Senate, Joseph Lieberman, failed to come across, President Obama wouldn't even place a phone call to change Lieberman's vote because he was on Lieberman's side. And President Obama's still a good man, and there's still lots of things to admire about him, but that was an awful decision. And simply trying to corral the Democrats back into the service of the pay-to-play faction of his party. It's one thing to ask people to be centrists. I regard myself as one. It's a democracy. I want to propose policies that solve real problems and that command the support of a majority. And there are questions that voters have about the things we propose that we better answer. But what Obama and the Clintons and Mike Bloomberg, whom I admire in many ways but disagree with strongly on these points, Deval Patrick, what they don't ever say a word about is the systemic corruption of pay-to-play politics and the real engines of economic inequality in our country. They put nothing on the table to solve them. Vice President Biden, he is a decent, good person in my view, but he gets into a closed room with Wall Street donors and reassures them, in his words, nothing fundamental will change.
Oh.
Well, something fundamental has to change. And again, the most important thing here is to defeat Donald Trump. I'm all for that idea, and I'm voting enthusiastically for whatever Democrat is nominated to make sure that this fascist is removed from office. That's the first order of business in our country right now. But if we don't change these other things, we'll be right where we are. And I still see that, outside of Sanders and Warren, I don't see anybody talking about healthcare change or climate change. I see no one talking about foreign and defense policy in ways that assure me that we can get on the right track and that we won't find ourselves in the same situation. We're so lucky that Trump is crazy. If he were only a fascist, I don't think we'd be even in a position to win this election.
You're right.
It's only because of his profound emotional impairment that we're at deuce, that we got a chance to pull this thing out.
Right.
And we may not be so lucky. The next Trump may be only fascist and not crazy. So it's time to win this election, yes, but it's also time to fix the fundamental problems in our political culture and in our political economy that have brought us to this moment.
You know, we talked a little bit about the impeachment hearings, and I think what's so important is that what we have to do is take those nuggets of facts, take those powerful statements, and I understand that 40% of the population watches Fox News and doesn't care about the facts and will follow Donald Trump to the ends of the earth. But you know
30.
What? All right, 30%.
40% still supports Trump because you have some traditional Republicans,
right.
But only 30 is in that hardcore group.
But you know what?
Good news.
That is good news, but I'm even willing to address the 30% because what they do by watching Fox is that it massages the lies, and it's the echo chamber for Donald Trump. And I need to figure out how I can get in between that. And I really do think that the Democrats need to figure out what is their marketing strategy, what is their media strategy, what is their conversational strategy. That, I mean, no one is going to sit like you and me for hours and hours and hours, maybe 20% of the population, maybe 30% of the population, but the vast majority won't. But they need to hear over and over some of those powerful things that we have heard that you said should be put in that leather-bound volume. And they need to hear it constantly, not once, not twice, but all the time. Because in the end, it pulls on their heartstrings of what they believe they want to raise their children to believe. I really do think this is about good parenting as much as about being a patriot.
A great philosophy teacher of mine once said, the most radical thing you can do is answer a child's question.
Yes, yes.
I think there's a lot to that. But yes, I agree. My great friend Ralph Nader lectured me often that about the power of aggregation, that every time the other side does something terrible, it's important to remind people of the three or four other times they also did it. So that everybody sees the pattern. And the second thing I would add to that is what you just said, and I think is extremely important. It's the power of repetition.
Right.
And every time they tell a lie, we have to tell a truth.
Yeah.
We can't just tell the truth scattershot while they're lying systematically.
Right.
So we have to show patterns so that people can connect dots, and we have to refute every lie. And it's tedious. And we often feel that we wish we could use the time for better purposes to explain larger problems, but we can't. Every lie needs to be exposed and rebutted every time. And that, by the way, is as true for people in the media as it is for Democrats, and even more important for people in the media because they get more airtime and we hear from them more.
Right.
And so they have to realize that whenever they're interviewing a Republican on television now, they have to correct every misstatement in real time.
It's absolutely.
And the networks and the papers have to hire people who are sufficiently conversant in policy to do that.
Yeah, and not only conversant in policy, but also understand that they also need to exercise courage. Remember we were talking about, you know, that was what happened after Watergate, was that it really inspired journalists. And what may happen now is that it may inspire people to enter into public life and enter into public service. And I really do think that what we need to remind journalists is that they're not there to serve MSNBC or CNN. They are there to serve the truth. That's their obligation.
And they want their audience to know that they're not on the Democratic side, since they're being accused of that all the time by the Republicans as part of their national gaslighting campaign. But what they have to remind themselves of is that if any Democrat comes on and lies the same way, be just as tough on them.
Exactly.
You're not on the Democrat side. You're on the side of the truth.
Exactly.
But you have to be on that side. And you are not simply, you know, an umpire. You're not just a moderator. You are there representing your readers and your listeners and your viewers.
Exactly.
And that means when you hear a lie, you got to call it out. That truly has not been the ideology of American journalism confuses even-handedness with objectivity. And it was always a mistake, but it's never been a more costly mistake than it is now. Even-handedness when both parties are as corrupted as they are, and one of them is so dangerously corrupted as it is, then every journalist has to be a kind of reformer. We need the kinds of journalists who sparked the progressive age. We need the Ida Tarbells, and we need the Lincoln Steffens and the Upton Sinclairs. We need people to be that kind of journalist, not just, you know, at Mother Jones and The Nation and on Democracy Now!, but we need that in the New York Times and at CNN.
So I want to go back to 2020 before I let you go, because I only have a few minutes left. And I want to talk to you a little bit about Bloomberg and Deval Patrick. And the reason I want to talk to you about these two is that people are saying it really shows a weakness in Biden. I'm not sure it shows a weakness in Biden. I think it shows a fear of the progressive agenda. And I think that's really why they are there. They're not there because they're seeing Biden sort of waffling. They are there because they are really worried, because the people that they have served, the people they have related to, the people they have connected with, those people do want to keep the status quo. And they are so afraid that they may suddenly walk away with their checkbooks, as if their checkbooks have done anything, but actually, as you just pointed out, created the great inequality, created the inability to sort of make the changes that we need to address climate change, to address what we need in the way of infrastructure and education and healthcare. And I think that's why they are entering this race. And that is what is so terrifying, that Warren and Bernie are the reason why they're doing it. It has nothing to do with Biden.
Yeah, I think, first of all, I think that's basically true. And I do think that the great mistake on the part of the establishment Democrats, if you listen to them talk about Medicare for All, that they sound like Republicans when they talk about it. I prefer a public option. I introduced the first public option in America in 1991 when I was the controller of the state of Connecticut. And if we set it up the right way, which would go further than any of the proposals on the table, there are ways to make that an absolute foundation of universal health care. And to begin with, you can leave people for the time being with private employers, but all the people who aren't insured have to be brought into this system. Mm-hmm. And all the current public employees have to be brought into the system. We ought to be setting up the largest single public health service in the world. Mm-hmm. And if some people want to stay for a while with their private employers, fine, let's get the system up.
Mazel tov.
There are pieces like that. But what you don't hear, instead of saying there are other ways to get to universal health care now, the establishment Democrats like Kamala Harris draft their health care proposals with industry lobbyists. And they spout rhetoric that could come from Republicans. Right. And there has to be this, progressives have to think about what compromises we do have to make. And I believe that will involve stressing two things. One, that everything we want to do is more efficient, less wasteful, and less expensive than the monopolistic system that we have now. Mm-hmm. Reform actually saves money. It's why Bernie Sanders was so well liked in Burlington.
No, you asked West Mayor. You're absolutely right.
Okay, it's absolutely correct. And we shouldn't be in these bidding wars that give up the reality that what, in fact, we're proposing, whether it's climate change or healthcare, costs a lot less. And the second thing is that we should be more skeptical of power in the public and private sector alike. Liberals, progressives fear concentrated power in the business sector. Conservatives fear concentrated power in government. And the average person simply fears concentrated power. And this is a war of everything small to be kept from being devoured by everything big. I recommend to any of your listeners who don't know it, E.F. Schumacher's Small is Beautiful. Hmm. And whether it's unions or the professions or small businesses or nonprofits, that huge corporate behemoth is gobbling up everyone and everything, including even the government itself.
Well, you know,
and so we have to begin to emphasize that this isn't just the war of one mass bureaucracy against another. This is the struggle of everyone small to get enough of a break to survive and maybe even one day flourish.
And I want to remind everyone, as you talked about Medicare for All and moving in that direction, not only do we start with the dollars, it is more cost effective. But more importantly, we also have to remind people, it will make us healthier and it will actually make us more secure. It is unbelievable. It is the three-legged stool on every level. On every level, it works. So I just want people to understand.
The reason we know it will work is that every other developed country in the world has been making it work for more than a generation.
Yeah.
There's all the data in the world. Better outcomes, better health care for all of us, longer, healthier lives for all of us, at a vastly reduced cost.
Exactly.
If we move from this system in which the for-profit health insurers get to be the gatekeepers between every single person in the system and the health care they need.
Exactly. On that note, Bill Curry, thank you so much for joining us. I needed a dose of Bill. All right.
Congratulations on the wedding.
Oh, my God. Thank you so much. All right, ciao. Bye-bye.
Okay, kid. Bye.
All right. A little labor history is next. This is The Attitude with Artie Artis. We'll be right back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1863. That was the day President Abraham Lincoln delivered the Gettysburg Address. It is considered one of Lincoln's greatest speeches. Generations of students have been assigned to commit it to memory. The two-minute speech carries a deep significance to our country's history. Lincoln delivered the speech at the dedication of the Soldiers' National Cemetery in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. 4 months earlier, the Union had defeated Confederate forces at the Battle of Gettysburg, the bloodiest battle of the Civil War. Casualties on both sides totaled nearly 50,000 over the course of the three-day battle. This battle, coupled with the fall of Vicksburg, is often considered the turning point in the war to end the slave labor system. Lincoln's speech served to redefine the war's purpose. Originally, the emphasis had been one of preserving the Union. Now, Lincoln drew upon the Declaration of Independence to also highlight the national struggle for human equality. Lincoln began his speech with the acknowledgement that the nation was dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. He ended the Gettysburg Address stating, "This nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from this earth." Most Republicans praised the speech, but historian Eric Foner notes in his biography of Lincoln that many Democrats denounced Lincoln for unilaterally redefining the war's purpose, which they insisted had nothing to do with equality. In 2015, the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library Foundation published an edited volume, Gettysburg Replies. It features 272 word essays by presidents, historians, poets, actors, scientists, and others about the lasting influence of the Gettysburg Address.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Rising seas and storm surge threaten many shoreline communities, but developers continue to build along the coast.
Every time you hear about a big storm, whether that's Houston or Sandy, people ask the question afterwards, why were we building in the first place? Why aren't we getting out of those areas?
Linda Shai of Cornell University's Department of City and Regional Planning says one of the reasons is city finances.
A lot of U.S. municipalities are very dependent on property taxes.
In her research, Shai has studied coastal communities in Massachusetts. There, she says, some municipalities generate as much as 70% of local revenue from property taxes. She says to keep that source of revenue stable and growing, many cities and towns continue to develop in flood-prone areas. Some see few alternatives, especially small communities with few places to expand. But as climate change continues, those decisions come with grave long-term risks, both to a city's finances and to the lives of the people who live on the coast. So Shai says it will require planning at the regional, state, and national level to help cities prepare for climate change and avoid building in harm's way. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
There is a wall, and it's the tallest wall of all. They named a street for it, where numbers roll and eyes go black. A wall of gold. They buy the future with the past, they call it work. Just feels like money in the bank. And way down at the foot of that wall where the guards can barely see her at all, a woman is standing, not asking, not demanding. A poor woman is standing with a hammer in her hand. Don't you want a piece of that wall when it comes down? Don't you want to live to see it fall when it comes round? When that wall is gone, no matter which side you were on, and you say you took a piece of that wall down.
All right, everyone, this is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Ken Barnes is not here, which is kind of ironic since Ken is the one that was talking about Kristallnacht on November 9th. And I was reading an article of The Conversation, and I thought as an homage to my producer, I would bring in our professor. But he is not here. So Fred Portnoy is sitting in, and he called a good friend of ours and said, is there a song that you play for Kristallnacht? And he said, well, let's try There Is a Wall by Charlie King. And that's what we played. So let me explain to you a little bit about who's joining us right now. Professor Wolf Gruner is joining us. He is a historian and a specialist on the Holocaust and German Jewish history. He's written 11 books. God, I wish, I'm so jealous I can't write one. 60 articles. And he's in the middle of writing a new book. But his additional areas of research include the comparative history of mass violence and its resistance on a global scale, as well as racial and state discrimination against indigenous populations. Professor Gruner, I really appreciate your joining us, and I'm also very grateful to TheConversation.com for bringing you to us, because I think it's really important not only that we look at what happened with Kristallnacht on November 9th to November 10th, 1938, but also to understand. I'm not sure it's not something that can't be repeated. If not, it's probably been repeated in places we just don't pay attention to. But I wanted you to sort of remind us not only about what happened, but also what was not recognized as to what happened. You talk about the synagogues that were destroyed. You talk about the businesses. What nobody ever commented on was the number of homes that were destroyed. And I went to Yad Vashem when I was in Israel many years ago, and I went to their website to see how they talked about Kristallnacht. And sure enough, they never mentioned the homes. They mentioned the businesses. They mentioned the synagogues. But what you noticed was the homes. And I want you to explain a little bit about what happened on that ominous day of November 9th to November 10th, and then explain to us why the idea that nobody had actually noticed the destruction of the homes is such a profound thing and so important for us to recognize. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Arnie. Thanks for having me, and it's a pleasure to join the program. So maybe first we have to establish what actually happened during this, during the night and the day. So all over Germany and annexed Austria, stormtroopers, SS, and Hitler Youth attacked Jewish property, Jewish synagogues, stores, and as I found out, also thousands of Jewish homes. The reason for the attacks were that the Nazi leadership realized that preparing for a war, which they had in mind already throughout 1938, would not work in their minds with remaining Jewish population in Germany. So they wanted to drive out the Jews, and this is, so to speak, the context for the extreme violence which was launched in November 1938. Why we overlooked that homes were attacked, I mean, it kind of is also, I have to blame myself. I did research on for 20 years, almost 30 years, on the Holocaust, especially on Germany. So I have read a lot of testimonies, and sometimes this actually pops up. Survivors talk about this, but the real impact on me made when I moved to USC, where the USC Shoah Foundation is housed with 55,000 survivor testimonies, video testimonies. Mm-hmm. So I started to watch interviews of German Jews, and almost everybody talked in great detail and brutal detail about the invasion of their private homes. And this is when it struck me that I never really read an analysis of this. I mean, how widespread was this? What was the intensity? So this is when I decided, after a while, I organized a conference on Kristallnacht last year for the 80th anniversary of these violent events, and that's when I decided to dig deeper. And when you start digging, then it practically evidence emerges everywhere, all over Germany, in small villages, big cities. So you find this in court records, in police records, in, as I said, in survivor testimonies in abundance.
So let me just read from your piece at theconversation.com, Professor Gruner, because I think it's really important, because people are like, well, so what? I mean, they were destructive. They were destroying everything. This was their intent. Why is mentioning the home so important and so profound, and why, having not noticed and not commented on it, important for us to do so now? And what you write in your piece is, in the immediate aftermath of Kristallnacht, most newspaper articles and photographs of the violent event exclusively focused on the destroyed synagogues and stores. In fact, when I went to Yad Vashem's website, guess what? That's exactly what they said. I mean, it was almost like you pulled it off of their website. And then you write, yet it was the destruction of the home, the last refuge for the German Jewish families who found themselves facing heightened public discrimination in the years leading up to the pogrom, that likely extracted the greatest toll on the Jewish population. The brutal attacks rendered thousands homeless, hundreds beaten, sexually assaulted, or murdered. The brutal assaults also likely played a big role in the spate of Jewish suicides that took place in the days and weeks after Kristallnacht, along with the decision that tens of thousands of Jews made to flee Nazi Germany. While this story speaks to the decades of scholarly neglect, it is at the same time a testament to the power of survivors' accounts, which continue to change the way we understand the Holocaust. The idea of the home, which is so sacred, if everything else around you falls apart, at least it's your refuge. It's your touchstone. And to see that they had to destroy that thing because they had to drive them out. There could be no place that they call home, especially any place in Germany.
Yeah, I agree. And really, when you look at the history of violence, which didn't start with Kristallnacht in Nazi Germany, it starts right in 1933. But it's kind of individual violence against certain Jewish individuals. It's against, as we know, against stores. But it never really, even in small programs which we now know about, it never really touches the privacy of the home. And over time, the increasing persecution practically covered all spheres of life. The only place where Jews could feel safe was in their private homes.
Right.
And I think this is what really make this kind of fundamental change in Kristallnacht for the Jewish families all over Germany.
And I want people to understand why this actually connects. I was thinking the other day about our immigration policy and about the people that are coming up from Latin America, and they're running away from home. How difficult that is. How important home is to you. And for you to abandon home means things have to be so incredibly terrible. And what I think is so interesting about Germany and the Jews is that the Jews couldn't quite believe it was actually happening. And the Germans wanted to remind the Jews it was. And the way to ensure that they knew that it was, you don't destroy their synagogues, you don't destroy their businesses, you destroy their homes. That was where they sent the ultimate message, you are not wanted here. I think that is so important. And I want people to understand, as I'm looking at people fleeing, you know, places in Latin America, leaving their homes because they are so terrified. The Germans understood how powerful the concept of home was. That was why they had to destroy that sense of place and that sense of safeness.
Yeah, and there's also one other aspect which is normally not thought about, is that the attacks of on the synagogues is kind of against targeting the Jewish religion. But many of the German Jews were assimilated. They were Protestants, Catholics, and they were perceived by the Nazis and declared as racial Jews. So these attacks on the homes covered targeted all of them. So
yeah.
That means one big kind of declared Jewish community. And I think that's also an aspect which should not be overlooked.
So, Professor Gruner, you study this. You look at this. I'm going to thread this into what I do for a living, which is not looking at German history, not necessarily. I mean, I have a knowledge of the Holocaust, but probably not as intimate a knowledge as you have. But as you are watching what is happening right now in America, and you are watching the dismantling of things that I hold dear, when you watch Colonel Vindman basically talk and so grateful to his father, having escaped Russia and having escaped a place where speaking out would ensure his death, and then you find out that the military is actually trying to protect Colonel Vindman because there have been so many threats on his life. Are you concerned about what is happening in America as you look back at your history and your knowledge of Germany and the Holocaust?
Yeah, I mean, it's always difficult to draw parallels, but there is one kind of lesson I think I try to teach my students, and this is you can't stop mass violence when you start with Auschwitz. You have to go back in the very beginnings of when this German society kind of turned into a genocidal society. And this starts with discrimination, othering of people, bringing the first Jews in concentration yes. camps, but also political enemies. So I think this is where the erosion of democratic institutions starts, and people often forget that Germany was a democracy because before the dictatorship was established. And it was not Hitler who kind of came in and suddenly said, oh, we are now erecting a dictatorship. The erosion and the destruction of the democracy started actually during the World Economic Crisis. It started in 1929, 1930, 1931, when certain powers were taken away from the parliament and given to kind of the leadership of the country. So there is kind of already a pathway paved to authoritarian dictatorship. So that's kind of what I think is very important to have in mind, that this starts earlier. It's not a one-man deal. This is kind of depending on these societal developments.
So this is really important. So there was a sort of sense of economic despair, and instead of recognizing the power of the parliament, they were looking for a stronger leader to solve the problem. Is that what it is? Do they sort of, I mean, I always feel like people look at Congress right now and they see how dysfunctional it is. It can't figure anything out. It can't fix anything. So therefore, maybe we need a strong leader to ultimately get us to what we need. And that's what Donald Trump offered. He offered solutions. He offered to be able to do what basically Congress was incapable of doing. Do you see the same parallels in Germany that ultimately led to the selection of Adolf Hitler?
Yeah, in a way, that, you are right, because during the big economic crisis, 6 million, towards the end, 6 million Germans were unemployed. It almost affected every family in Germany, the crisis. So everybody was looking for how to solve these problems, and it was kind of started the image was created that the parliament is kind of stalled because there's too much discussion. It takes too long.
Yes.
You need very fast kind of decisions, and fast decisions can only made kind of at the level of one the leader, strong leadership. And this is kind of where first generals were kind of elected, and then it led in the end to kind of appointing Hitler as the chancellor.
So as you have been doing your studies, and you do look at other areas of the world, not just what happened with Nazi Germany, what are you noticing? I just feel like the world is moving into that direction. We are so frightened by inequality. We are so frightened by climate change. We are so frightened by there's such a lack of trust, in part because now that the world is so connected because of the social media, what is also connecting us is our sense of both fear and blame. And I'm trying to figure out how, as you teach this to your students, we can be giving them the tools to know how to address it going into the future. How do you give people a sense that this can be repaired, that this can be changed? I mean, we had a World War II, but look what we had to do in order to remove a Hitler. Other than another world war, how do we give people a sense that it is okay, that things take time? What we ultimately need is to figure out that we're invested in those decisions.
Yeah, so maybe I start from the other end. And first, I kind of try to teach my students that the Holocaust, in a sense, and the violence which happened against the Jews, was not a unique kind of an exception in history. We find this, these similar things, like the extreme nationalism, the othering of minorities, in a lot of countries in world history. And for example, right. in the 19th century, and many of these processes start for similar reasons. That means there is kind of a political and economic crisis, and people think that blaming a minority is kind of solving this. So there is this. What I try to instill in the students is that the danger that a democracy turns into a dictatorship is always there. It's everywhere, and so we have to work on kind of preventing this from the very start. And I think that's exactly the point. It is not, it is difficult to repair the damage when it's done, but you can try to prevent the damage before if actually it happened.
And what are the tools to preventing it? I mean, I many, many years ago, I ran for Congress, and I was a liberal progressive. It was right around the time of the welfare reform bill and the crime bill. And I was actually, as a Democrat, running against the crime bill and the welfare reform bill, which unfortunately was supported by my president, Bill Clinton, at the time. And I remember going into a room where there were a group of unemployed people in the north country of my state. The paper mills were shutting down. The timber industry was dying. And these people were very angry and feeling somehow that their future was being challenged. And they remember they attacked me. And one of the reasons they attacked me was that they said, you like welfare women. You don't care about us. And I looked at them and I'm like, what are you talking about? And they said, Arnie, we work 60 and 70 hours a week and nobody gives us health care. But those welfare women, they get Medicare. We work 60 and 70 hours a week. Those women get, you know, Head Start for their children. We don't get, and we're going with this whole laundry list of things where the level of resentment was just enormous. And you know what, Wolf? One of the things I thought was I understood their anger. I understood their resentment. But what was so interesting to me is look at who they blamed. They blamed welfare women for taking away their economic stability. And I remember looking at them saying, it isn't something wrong with welfare. There's something wrong with work. When you can work 70 hours and can't go to a doctor when you're sick, that's not because of a welfare woman. That's because of something wrong with work. And that was in 1996. And I figured we've perfected the blame game even better today. And Donald Trump has been wildly successful at that. That not only explains his election, it explains the potential for his reelection. So how do you take and divert the blame so people understand what's real as opposed to what's not?
I'm not a politician. I'm an historian, so I look back and try to kind of stay away from judgments today. But what I see is that it is a lot about priorities of the government and where are you putting your money at. I mean, it's not that the United States or Germany at the time that they were kind of poor countries. So they were developed countries. So the question is, what are your priorities? Are you, like Germany, giving all the money to the military to kind of pursue a rearmament to kind of revise the effects of the Versailles Treaty after the First World War, right? Then you don't have money for other purposes. So I think it's a lot about the distribution and priorities of the budget one state has. And I think when you don't look into this, then it looks like, oh, there's a scarcity, there's a crisis situation, and the little money we have is kind of is going to different, let's say, people we don't think they deserve this.
Well, you know, you wrote in the conversation.com about Kristallnacht, and you talked about what happened. And one of the things that I also want to look at as a parallel, which I also think is important, because again, this is not unique behavior what happened in Nazi Germany. And I'm going to give a parallel to what happened just the other day. Trump pardons for servicemen raise fears, the laws of war are history. And this is, I don't know if you followed that story, but what happened is the military officials did not want the president to pardon this major, Matthew Goldstein, of the Army Special Forces, because, in fact, he had done something that deserved discipline, because he basically ordered, he killed people. You know, and he ordered the killing, and this was something that they said, no, 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 you need to understand, we need to establish this order, that this is not to be accepted. And what Donald Trump does by basically, you know, restoring him back to as a private citizen is something the military accepted, but they understood it eroded their ability to determine for their troops what is right and what is wrong. And I think that's another thing that we're beginning to see happen with Donald Trump. It's not only the othering, it's that we don't even value right and wrong, especially when the military is saying, you are wrong, Mr. President, but we will follow through.
Yeah, also, there is the role of the military to be objective and not partisan. And I think there is a great deal done to kind of politicize the military, but also not only the military, the whole administration. I think this is kind of very similar what happened in the 1930s, that Hitler was very keen, and he established very early a law to change kind of civil servantship. And kind of cleared the administration, the German administration, from Jews and communists, and brought all his people into the administration, which totally changes the course of the country.
Well, and again, I just want to remind everyone, these people were accused of war crimes. They were convicted mm-hmm. of war crimes. And what is, and the military does not want this man, you know, to be restored back to civilian life. And yet that's exactly what he did. So now the question is, what is a war crime if there is no, if there's no idea that there are consequences to this? And again, I just feel like I look back at Nazi Germany and I look at Donald Trump and I'm thinking, there are too many similarities. We need to be vigilant. We need to be vigilant. Your piece at theconversation.com. Look at Kristallnacht, and basically what you were saying in your piece, there are stories that we are not aware of, and that is the forgotten mass destruction of Jewish homes during Kristallnacht, and how important it is not just to look at the businesses, but the importance of home and what it meant to not only the Jews, but what it means as we look forward and we look past into history. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor Gruner.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And we end with this. We end with Aretha Franklin and Think. Just